The sexual revolution has wreaked devastation on our culture and our society. How do we recover and help the survivors? That's what we're going to talk about today on Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, just want to ask people to like and subscribe to the channel. Let other people know about it. The channel is growing. And I really appreciate all those who have shared it with others. Let's go ahead and get started. Our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris. She is the founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She was a campaign spokeswoman for California's winning Proposition 8 campaign, defining marriage as a union between a man and a woman. How shocking.
I know.
She has authored or co-authored 6 books and spoken around the globe on marriage, family, and human sexuality. Her latest book is The Sexual State, How Elite Ideologies Are Destroying Lives, and Why the Church Was Right All Along. Welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be with you, Eric. I've been a Crisis reader for a long time, back to the Ralph McInerney and James Shaw days, right?
So
it's very nice. Not all publications survive, you know?
Yes, so we're actually celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. It will be in November. We'll be 40 years old. So yeah,
That's very wonderful. Good for you.
Been around for a long time.
And to pass the torch successfully, you know?
Yes, that's a big thing. Exactly. Yeah. I read a book by you. This was a while ago. Oh gosh! Now the tiles blanking. Something that taking off of Hillary Clinton's "It Takes a Village." You had.
Yes.
What was that book called?
Okay, it was called "Love and Economics."
Yes,
it takes a family to raise a village.
Yes, I love that book. I remember reading that. When did that come out?
So it was originally published by Spence Publishing in 2001 with a different subtitle, and the subtitle, no one could understand the subtitle. So when Spence went out of business, the rights reverted to me. And so the Ruth Institute brought it out again. I think we brought it out again with that subtitle in 2008 and paperback only, you know, so.
Yes. That's I think I got it maybe a year or two after it came out. And I just thought it was an excellent book just on, I kind of like dabble in economics. And so just seeing the biggest problem I've always had, I tend to support libertarian economics, but I always feel like the family is kind of left out of the equation too often in discussions, which is why I loved your book, because making the family as the center point of economics is really, I think, a Catholic way of looking at it.
Well, I didn't really know it was a Catholic way of looking at it when I first did it, you know, but I just thought it was applied natural law.
Right.
You know, and for me, it was the experience of going from being a free market economist to being a full-time mom to 2 children within 6 months time, because that's a whole story, you know, and I don't know if you remember that from the book, but that it just became so clear to me that children need their parents. We adopted a little boy from Romania who was 2.5 years old when we got him. So he had been in very minimal care for, you know, 2 years of the first 2.5 years of his life. And then 6 months later, we gave birth to a baby girl. Well, you know, you got me, I'm a nerd, my husband, engineer, nerd, total nerd, right? We look at it, it's a science experiment, right? This is a controlled experiment. What difference does it make whether you have a mother and father in your life, you know? And of course you can see, oh my gosh, it makes so much difference. And so that's what propelled my mind down that path that led to the book Love and Economics. Those kids came in 1991. That was our big year. And then, you know, 10 years later, I had written the book by that time, you know, but it turned everything upside down. You know, you can't be a let's leave everybody alone to do their own thing kind of libertarian anymore once kids enter the picture, you know. And since everybody enters the world as a child, you know, last I looked, this is like the universal human experience. It's not like some small thing you can set aside, you know, that's what, you know, turned my life into a very particular path where I still am on that path, you know.
Right. Sounds like that's very connected to your founding of the Ruth Institute, this idea of, I mean, really protecting children and helping them after they've had to go through some experience that is not the ideal of a mother and father at home with them, taking care of them. So tell us a little bit about the Ruth Institute and when you founded it and kind of the purpose behind it.
Yes. So I founded the Ruth Institute in 2008 when we still lived in San Diego. And my kids were getting older and, you know, didn't need me as much. We had done foster care for a few years, so we were done with that. And, you know, it was time to move on to something else. And I always had it in my mind that I wanted to have some kind of a think tank. I kind of modeled myself on the Acton Institute, if you know the guys at Acton. Mm-hmm. And I've been involved with Acton for a long time, from the beginning, really. And so I admired them and saw what they had accomplished and so on. I thought that, well, that's a good path for me now that I'm, of course, once you leave a tenure track position, which I had left my tenured position at George Mason, you're completely unemployable after that, you know, no one will ever touch you again in academic life. So I think, you know, I'm going to do what I want. And when I started the Ruth Institute in 2008, Eric, I thought that what I was going to do is to talk to college age women about why they need not be afraid to start their families, and why they don't have to wait until they've made partner in the law firm or gotten tenure or, you know, all those kind of things that a lot of us were really primed to think about because we thought, well, we have to compete with the men and we have to do what the guys do and the babies aren't so important and, you know, they'll be there, you know, all that kind of stuff. I wanted to tell people that that wasn't right. And that they could, that it'd be okay if you started your family, you know, sometime before menopause kicks in, you know. but then in 2008 in San Diego, something happened that I didn't expect, which was Proposition 8. Proposition 8, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, is the a ballot initiative to amend the California Constitution to make marriage the union of one man and one woman. Well, that actually started in San Diego. At that time, the auxiliary bishop of San Diego was Salvatore Corleone, and he got the whole thing going. And it was really Catholics in San Diego who raised the money to get it on the ballot. And then once it was on the ballot, all these other people, all these other groups came together to get the thing through. So I had literally just started the Ruth Institute, and I got recruited to be involved in this. And I didn't really want to get involved in gay stuff. You know, I just don't mind saying that. That's not really where I wanted to go. In fact, I don't know anybody who really wants to get involved in those issues, but I felt like I couldn't sit it out because I had so much knowledge about how children need their mothers and fathers. And you could see, if you thought about it very much, you could see that if you redefine marriage, you're going to end up redefining parenthood. And kids are going to end up separated from their natural mother and father. And all these are the consequences we've already seen, you know, from broken down families and so on. They're, all those things are going to follow in the, you know, if you redefine marriage and you have two guys raising a kid, you're going to have problems, you know. And so I didn't feel I could sit it out. So I got involved in that. And the Ruth Institute has been, you know, involved in those type of issues ever since. And so over time, I came to see and you feel very strongly that if you try to just deal with gay marriage without talking about any other part of the sexual revolution, you're not really going to be completely credible, you know, yeah. Because we used to like to say, and the campaign used to say this, and they would say, kids need a mother and a father. And I remember sitting there, you know, even the first time I heard it, I'm like, you know, that's not really good enough. You know, they need their own mother and their own father, wherever that is possible, that's what they need. But nobody wanted to talk about that because they didn't want to get involved in a fight about divorce, right? And if I'm like, you know, a lot more kids lose their parents to divorce than are ever going to lose it over gay marriage, right? So we really need to at least be prepared to talk about it, even if we don't bring it up all the time. We can't sit there with, you know, flat-footed when somebody else brings it up, you know, like, oh, I don't have anything to say. Let's talk about something else. Yeah. I just couldn't do that, you know. So anyway, that kind of over the years it kind of expanded until now. I would say we're the one stop shop to deal with anything that has to do with the sexual revolution.
Yeah. So let's get back then to the sexual revolution and how would you? I mean, it's interesting because I'm sure in the 1960s, if you had told some advocate of the sexual revolution, by the way, what this will lead to is drag shows for kids.
Right.
I think they would have thought you were insane. Right. And just said, that's the worst slippery slope argument I've ever heard in my life.
Right.
Yet, here we are in 2022. And what's the, you know, of course, that's exactly what's happening. So let's go back then to the sexual revolution. What were the promises made by the sexual revolution? And why were they flawed from the beginning?
Well, that's a huge question. And I have a book that was published by Tan Publishing called The Sexual State, How Elite Ideologies Are Destroying Lives and Why the Church Was Right All Along is the subtitle. And in that book, I break down the sexual revolution into three main ideologies, kind of interlocking ideologies. And the reason I do that, Eric, is because there seems like there's so many parts to it, but you can really, there's really only three big ideas. Everything you're seeing can be broken down into one of those three big ideas. And I think that's easier for people to manage, you know, to think it through, and, you know, they feel less overwhelmed by it. So the first big idea was the contraceptive ideology. And the idea there was that a good society should do everything possible to separate sex from babies, because after all, everybody knows by now, by the 60s, everybody knows that Freud has taught us, and all these people have taught us, that if we repress our sexuality, we're going to be crazy. And you can't have a happy life if you repress your sexuality, and these taboos are terrible, and so on and so forth. So the only way you can, you know, have your fulfilled sex life is to somehow eliminate the connection with babies, you know. And so that's the whole contraceptive piece, plus the abortion piece as a backup to in case of a contraceptive failure. And it's just the whole concept that sex is an entitlement. Sexual activity is an entitlement. And in my opinion, that led to the Me Too movement. You know, I mean, what exactly do you think is going to happen if you tell everybody that they're entitled to sex without any bad, and nothing bad's ever going to happen? You know, what, who's exactly empowered by that? I ask you, you know, well, the predator is empowered by that, right? So that's one set of ideas, all wrapped up in a nice shiny bow, you know, that women are going to be empowered and we're going to be equal and we're going to be happy, so on and so forth. Every child is going to be a wanted child. You see, that's the next thing. So those were some of the promises, which, you know, as soon as you say them, you realize they're ridiculous. You know, they didn't happen. They're not going to happen. They can't happen. The second ideology is what I call the divorce ideology, because that is what says that a good and decent society should not only separate sex and babies, it should and is entitled to, everybody's entitled to separate sex and babies from marriage. So you can have sex without being married. You can have babies without being married. You can be married without having babies. You know, there's no necessary connection between any of these things. And underlying that ideology, which is very seldom stated right next to each other, you know, there's divorce ideology over here. Divorce is fine. Over here is the idea of kids are resilient. Kids are so resilient. They'll be fine. You can do anything you want. Don't worry about the kids. They're fine. They're so resilient. You know, well, you park those two things up next to each other and it's ridiculous, right? It's so clearly self-serving. We get to do what we want and the kids will be fine. We're so fragile as adults. We must have our, you know, our needs met, you know, but the kids will be fine no matter how many times we switch out our sex partners, no matter how much we disrupt their living arrangements, you know, no matter how many boyfriends I bring home, nothing bad's going to happen. That's crazy. And then the third ideology of the sexual revolution is what I call the gender ideology. And this encompasses some forms of feminism. Feminism is a big amorphous thing, so I want to be a little cautious about the word feminism because it means a lot of things to a lot of people. But there's a part of feminism, surely everyone would agree, there's a part of feminism which says that the sex of the body is not particularly significant and that we can rewrite social roles and cultural roles any way we want. And of course, we want equality, so therefore we'll socially engineer everything to make men and women equal. But along with that has also come the idea that the body is so insubstantial that if you want to change the body itself, you can do that too. And that's where we are now. And so that's how feminism and homosexuality and transgenderism, how all those things are linked. They're linked by the idea that the body doesn't really matter very much. And we can either socially engineer or medically engineer our way to any combination of things that we want. And like always with the sexual revolution, nothing bad will happen to anyone.
Right. Of course not.
No.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned those three parts of kind of sexual revolution. The first two in particular, like, whereas we know that it's really natural law, the idea yes. that obviously sex and procreation are connected and marriage and family and babies are all connected and things like that. Yet, it's also true that the Catholic Church is really the only institution that's standing up against contraception, at least officially. I know there's issues in the Catholic Church, but you know, we all know that.
No kidding.
Yeah, right. That's the understatement, yeah, right?
We have issues. All right, exactly. Protestant brothers and sisters who are watching, I have a lot of non-Catholic followers, Eric, just so you know. So
that's actually what I'm coming to.
Oh, okay. Mormon brothers and sisters, evangelical brothers and sisters, listen up. We know we have issues. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay, go ahead.
Exactly. And we, you know, like crisis, we have a number of, in fact, I just got an email today from a Protestant reader of ours. But the idea, though, is that contraception, divorce, it's the Catholic Church at least officially still stands up against right. that. And most Protestant denominations have not done that.
Correct.
And so my question is, Ruth Institute is obviously a faith, interfaith coalition.
Right.
How do you navigate that to not underplay the importance of those evils, really, contraception, right. divorce, yet you deal with a lot of non-Catholics who their faith tradition may accept both or at least one of those.
Right, right. So I have a very strict policy about this, Eric. My policy is that I will talk to anyone who will listen, which narrows the field more than you might think, actually. but seriously, you know, what we say about ourselves, as part of our, you know, what do you call it, our mission statement, value statement, whatever those things are that you're, you know, that we try to keep focused on, you know, is that we will work with individuals and groups who share our views in whole or in part. You know, so if somebody wants to join us on one issue and they're not 100% on board with any other issues, that's okay. I try not to pick fights with people unnecessarily, and certainly within the staff and, you know, our events and things like that. You know, we never talk about the filioque clause and staff meetings and stuff like that. You know, we really don't.
That's for after hours at the
bar. Yeah, that's right. A few beers. We'll talk about that. Well, our Mormon friends will be sipping their ginger ales or whatever.
Yeah, right.
But no, I feel that my personal vocation is to hold the door of the church open. You know, I'm at the door of the church, holding the door open for anybody who wants to come through. And honestly, there are people who look at what we're doing and who listen and to listen to what the church has to say. And they're like, this, you know, in my heart, I believe this, whatever this is. This is what I've always believed, but I can't explain it. Can you explain it? Dr. Morse, can you explain this? That happens to me all the time. That used to happen all the time in Prop 8, right? You know, that people would know in their hearts that they were hearing something that wasn't right. You know, but I gave them the words for it, you know, and I think the Catholic Church gives them the words and the intellectual structure, you know, to see how it all fits together. It's coherent. It's been thought through. You know, I didn't make this up myself. You know, we're standing on standing on the shoulders of some real giants in a lot of ways. And so that's how we navigate it. You know, we say what we have to say, and I don't shrink from anything that I think needs to be said. And anybody who wants to gather around, gathers around, you know, and not everybody gathers around on every point, but you'd be surprised how often it happens to me that I'll be talking to either a mixed audience or even an evangelical audience. And somebody will raise their hand and say, Dr. Morse, I'm an evangelical. We want to hear more about contraception. Right. Tell us more about this. I'm like, okay, I'd be glad to, you know, so,
yeah, I remember when I was a Protestant in the pro-life movement, I thought the Catholics were insane to be against contraception. It just was I was very young. I was dumb. But here's the thing is I had never heard anything argued against it.
Yes.
So I just accept it because that's what you do. It wasn't like I had thought it through and like, okay, let's look at the different arguments for and against it. And then when I started hearing, but my first reaction was, you people are insane. How could you be against contraception? Then over time, listening to the arguments, I'm like, wait a second, this is actually makes sense. And I can see how it's connected to abortion.
Right.
And that's what it seems like you're doing. You're trying to put together that we're not here where we are in 2022 just because of some, you know, abortion got legal or something like that. It's far more than that. It's much more. And so I'm glad you're able to bring that together.
Yes. And for you, what was the thing that, you know, when you said I first started hearing arguments, who did you hear them from? What did you hear? What clicked for you, Eric?
Okay. So this was in the early 90s. And so I was in college at the time and I was dating a girl and I'd been dating her long term. We ended up breaking up, but when we when we thought about marriage, we just assumed, both of us, that we continue to use contraception in our marriage. But then somebody, a Catholic friend, was basically just like, why would you want to restrict the children God might give you in marriage? Like, it wasn't even talking about, like, I could understand, like, I was against sexual promiscuity at the time and sex outside of marriage. And so obviously I wasn't, like, you couldn't argue for contraception there because I was already against having relations outside marriage. But for me, it was like, it was fine in marriage. But they were like, but hold on a second. I thought, like, when you get married, this is a Catholic saying this, like, wouldn't you want any gifts that God would give you, like, be open to life and things like that? And they say it much better than I am right now. But and it just got me thinking, like, hold on a second. Why would I get married in the first place? Like, why would what is the reason? Right. Is it just so I can have a friend that I can live with for the rest of my life? Or is there something deeper to it than that? Right. And that then starts the road of, that goes down a whole bunch of paths. And then you get you have a whole different way of even looking at marriage itself. It's not just a partnership between two people, but there's an actual end to it, a purpose to it. So that's where I was.
Yes. And that's what we have lost, say. And that's what was so difficult about trying to defend man-woman marriage without ever talking about anything else, because I finally figured out this three-part typology that I just explained to you. Mm-hmm. I figured that out over the years of trying to defend man-woman marriage, because I realized in people's minds, they had already redefined marriage. You know, they had already redefined marriage to make it intrinsically sterile, to be about the adults, not about the children, and that the sex of the body wasn't particularly significant, you know. And so I realized my objection to gay marriage was to redefining it even further by removing the gender requirement explicitly. What you're doing is taking all these things which were false in the first place, and you're solidifying them, entrenching them even more deeply in the law. It's bad enough now, people. Are we really going to take another step in this direction? Well, that's a hard argument to make in the context of a political campaign. Although we won quite a few elections, right. And we lost it in the courts. So I just became convinced that it was necessary for somebody to do the long-term work of saying, I don't care about the next election. You know, I don't care about the next court case. Somebody else can worry about that. I'm going to spell this out as logically and as completely as I can, so that whoever's doing that work, they have something solid to build on. And so the people don't have to be so afraid, you know. I'll tell you this one story, Ben. This is Prop 8 story. As you may remember, we won in the state of California, right? The voters of California in 2008 voted in favor of man-woman marriage. And we were in court almost immediately. The elites of society brought that to court. And it was financed by Rob Reiner, the Hollywood guy, right? He put a bunch of money on the table to finance this court challenge. The government of California, including the attorney general, refused to defend the law, which the law was man-woman marriage now, right? And it's the duty of the attorney general to defend the laws of the state. They refused to defend it, right? So we ended up in court just to get standing for the campaign to defend it. All kinds of court challenges. And I was in the courtroom in California numerous times. I was there as an observer because, you know, I had been involved and so on. And I remember this one time we were in court. It was the Ninth Circuit, and Judge Stephen Reinhardt, you know, was presiding over it. I don't know if people remember him, but he was Mr. Liberal Lion. OK, and he was the guy who was largely responsible for how out of control that court was. So we were having oral arguments, and our attorney, the pro Prop 8 attorney, was standing up there, you know, talking about how children need a mother and a father. And Reinhardt said something along the lines of, well, why don't you outlaw divorce then? Ha, 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 ha. And the whole courtroom burst out laughing. And I just wanted to jump up and yell at our attorney, answer him.
Yeah.
Answer him. Please say something, you know. And of course he didn't. And of course we lost. And of course, then it turned out that his daughter married a woman. And it was just one impossible thing after another with that whole court thing. But, you know, so, you know, as things developed, it just became clear that whatever else other people were going to do, that my personal vocation was going to need to be to take this intellectually, you know, and build the foundation that people could work on and have something solid to work with.
And I think one of the reasons why we don't want to ask the divorce question, for example, is because it has a personal impact on so many people. I mean, either as children of divorce or divorcees themselves.
Yes.
And that's one thing I wanted to talk about next, which was, so when most of us think about the sexual revolution, and if you ask me, for example, who was harmed by the sexual revolution, my first thought, and I think a lot of people's first thought would be, for example, the woman who sleeps around, thinking that's going to bring her some type of joy, some type of happiness. And of course it doesn't. She's being used by multiple boyfriends, things like that. But what I've noticed when I was looking through what the Ruth Institute do and your upcoming summit you're going to have, we'll talk about more in a moment, is you talk a lot about the survivors of sexual revolution, people who are impacted more indirectly in the sense that they were not doing the things that the sexual revolution said to do, but instead, because other people around them were doing it, it harmed them. Who are some of these people who have been harmed, kind of more secondhand smoke, so to speak, of the sexual revolution?
Right. Well, the biggest category would be the children of divorce, you know, because they are certainly innocent parties, right? They didn't do anything wrong. And yet when their parents decided to divorce for whatever reason, and there are a lot of reasons that people decide to get divorced, and there are a lot of stories, okay, the children, their lives are turned upside down. And it has been shown numerous times, Eric, numerous times. There is simply no doubt that children are harmed by their parents' divorce. And that's true almost irregardless of what else was going on in the marriage. Now, not 100%, but it has to be really, really bad, not a low conflict, moderate conflict kind of marriage. It has to be a super high conflict marriage where people are getting beat up and there's drugs and so on and so forth. Short of that, kids are harmed by their parents' separation and divorce, and they are certainly harmed by their parents' subsequent repartnering, whether they get married again or whether they just have a string of new lovers that come through the house. Those new relationships are very disruptive and very hurtful to children on all sorts of levels, okay? And there's no empirical doubt about that whatsoever. There are literally hundreds of studies showing one case after another, one, you know, social indicator after another, you know, that kids are harmed by that. So the children of divorce are certainly an innocent party who suffer tremendously from the divorce ideology. Likewise, the abandoned spouse. Now, here's a fact you probably don't know because we're about the only people who ever talk about this. We have this narrative in society. You know, the revolutionary narrative is, well, no-fault divorce is important because when two adult, mature people decide that they've had enough, why should the state have any interest in keeping a loveless marriage together? Okay, that's the narrative. You know, so it suggests to you that the two people have agreed that they've settled their differences amicably, like grownups, and it's like a transaction or a contract that's being, whose dissolution is being negotiated, and everyone's better off if you can do that at lower cost. That's the narrative behind no-fault divorce. It was a narrative behind passing it, and people still tell that story. What people don't know is that at least 75% of divorces have a reluctant party, meaning it's not mutual at all, right? One party wants to get divorced. One party wants to stay married. Now, the implications of that are vast, simply vast, right? Because number one, it means that the state must intervene to break up the marriage because there's one person who wants to stay. And what no-fault divorce really means is unilateral divorce. And it really means that the state always take sides with the person who wants the marriage the least. That's what no-fault divorce actually means. It doesn't mean neutral arbitration or, you know, just low-cost separation. It doesn't mean any of that. It means one party can end the marriage unilaterally. And then as soon as you do that, now the family court's involved. And so that reluctant party who'd like to stay married, that person's got to be separated from the marriage. They have to give up all the assets of the marriage. They have to be, you know, the court gets to divide the assets, which generally means the family home and the time with the children and the influence over the children's life. When you really think about it, it is profoundly unjust. And very few people will say that the abandoned spouse, the reluctantly divorced party, that person has had some injustice done to them. And, you know, and I know a lot of people that call themselves standers, you know, who are standing for their marriage. And people tell them, oh, you got to move on. Oh, you're interfering with your ex's chances for happiness, you know, so on and so forth. But the fact is, they're trying to be loyal. They're trying to be loyal. And they've made a vow, and they're taking that vow seriously. I don't know how you can have a great civilization if you incentivize disloyalty on the scale that we have incentivized disloyalty. Think about that.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the divorce is just, it's just so widely accepted though.
Yeah.
And so how do you help people, like for example, children of divorce, how do you actually practically help them?
Yeah. So we tried to have workshops on healing family breakdown, and we did okay with it, but it's not really our forte. There's another group that does that type of work. Dan and Bethany Mayola, who are actually coming to our summit because I wanted to highlight them. They put on retreats and workshops and things for adult children of divorce to help them, because that's a whole unique vocation, right? To be involved in any kind of therapeutic stuff. And that isn't really, you know, who I am and what I do. But I think our contribution as the Ruth Institute is to call attention to it and to say, look, this is a thing. And don't you dare tell the kids they need to get over it. Don't you dare tell them they'll be okay. I mean, stop, just stop with that, you know? So Dan and Bethany can be nice about it, and we're not nice about it as much. You know, we're like, stop, you gotta stop that.
So how should a person, so let's say a sibling is getting divorced. Yeah. This has happened to so many of us, of course. They say, you know, okay, you know, so-and-so and I, we just, you know, maybe 20 years, 10 years, whatever the case may be, and they're getting divorced, and they have kids. What is the path that the person, like the sibling, should take this in that situation? Because the common thing everybody says is, oh, you have to support it. You have to support it. You have to go along with it, basically, because you're just going to make things worse. What actually should a person do in that situation?
Well, if you resist it, if you say, you know, really, you should slow this whole thing down, they won't. A lot of times they won't be happy with you. Right. And so it will be uncomfortable in that moment. But I think the way to, and it's delicate, admittedly, it's delicate. It's one thing for me to stand at the podium and talk in a general way. It's a very different thing for you to talk to your brother or your sister or something like that. And there are many facets to this. I mean, I think the feminine approach to divorce and the masculine approach to divorce, very different, you know, when a man's initiating versus when a woman's initiating. Is there a new boyfriend or a new girlfriend in the picture? You know, all those type of questions go into how you would, as a practical matter, approach it. But I think I think the one thing that you can say, in pretty much any situation, you know, look, if you have kids here, you're going to tell them, look, mommy and daddy still love you. I'm presumably they're going to say that, right? Mommy and daddy still love you. We just don't love each other anymore. Well, look, your spouse, whom you don't love anymore, is half of who your child is. So when you tell your child, we don't love each other anymore, but we still love you, that doesn't actually add up in their little six-year-old mind or whatever. And because in point of fact, it doesn't really add up at all, because that's half of their identity. That's half of their body, is that other person that you're now saying you don't love anymore. And so I think there really is something to be said to, quote, staying together for the sake of the kids. It's very important. And the fact is, a lot of the things that upset us in our married life, we can overcome them. And it's not like you're going to leave one marriage and go off and, you know, instantly find bliss, wedded bliss. You know, there are going to be problems in the next phase of your life. And I have heard many times, Eric, many times I've heard people say, if I had known how hard divorce was going to be, I would have worked harder at my marriage.
Yeah.
You know, so that's another factor to put into the equation.
Yeah. Now the sexual revolution, of course, I mean, my goodness, the everything that it's done to destroy our culture is just immense. But now the latest one, of course, I mean, it kind of went from, I feel like it went contraception, we have divorce, we have abortion, we have homosexuality, and now, of course, it's transgenderism.
Right.
And this one, I feel like, I wrote about this recently, I feel like this might be where they finally are crossing a line that the average person just can see, okay, now you've gone too far. Like, we both know that natural law was broke all the way back at contraception.
Right.
But, like, I think the average person can say, hold on a second, that is a guy. That's not a gal who's right. swimming in that swim meet.
Right.
How
right.
do you equip people to refute the lies of the transgenderism movement, which is, you know, as you know, being shoved down our throats right now?
Right. Right. Well, I read your article on this subject,
okay.
by the way. I saw your article. And here's what I would say. I agree with you that this is a step too far. And that a lot of people are saying this is too much and you can't bamboozle everybody forever. You know, there are a lot of people who just say, no, that's a dude. Stop it. Just stop it with me. You know, I just don't even go there. That's very important. It's a very important, very positive development. The only thing that where I would take issue with you is I would never say anything that would suggest to people that, oh, well, it's going to take care of itself because they've gone too far. No, people, right. you got to fight. You've got to stay in the fight, you know, and the fact that they're crazy, you know, it should have, you would think it would have imploded a long time ago, but, right. but it doesn't implode. And these are people who are hungry for power. The people, not the immediate activists, but for sure the people behind them who are financing all this stuff, the people who are cheerleading and writing the scripts for all this stuff, you know, the people who are orchestrating the whole thing, those people are power mad and they are not going to give it up just because they're crazy. Okay. I mean, you've got to keep pushing and you've got to make them look bad and you've got to make a nuisance of yourself in various ways, you know? But I am encouraged by the fact that there are quite a few ordinary folk, you know, who are showing up at libraries, who are showing up at school boards and who are putting up a stink. About this type of stuff, you know, and that some of it, you know, every once in a while you'll see somebody actually backpedal. So there's nothing automatic about it, but the good point is that it's happening so rapid fire that, and the lies are coming so quickly next to each other that there are people today who can remember what it was like 2 weeks ago and it wasn't that crazy and you can't completely fool everybody, you know, whereas when it's a slow moving train wreck, it's hard for people to remember. Oh, there was a time when mothers and fathers stayed married for a lifetime, and yeah, they quarreled sometimes, but it wasn't really as awful as we're made to think.
Right.
You know, it's harder to sustain that memory. So that's the way I would answer that, Eric.
Okay. Yeah. And I think you're right about the fighting. I will make sure I encourage everybody to do it too, because like a great example is like how this month in June, how you have Pride Month stuff shoved down our throats, especially for example, at your local library.
Yeah.
So even a library in a red state, a red county, a red area, a pro, you know, maybe they voted like 80% for Trump or something like that.
Right.
They're still going to have the pride display
right.
at their library.
Right.
And especially if nobody says anything about it, if nobody says, yeah, right. wait a second, I'm not going to come here. This is my taxpayer dollars going towards this. And you got to take this stuff down. So and I think that's where we probably have the most power. Obviously is local,
yes.
not necessarily change somebody in Washington, D.C., but in literally your backyard almost,
yes.
the library down the street is a
well, and when you park. Think about it, too, I mean, there have been numerous instances around the country now where drag queen story hours have been canceled, where books have been taken out, you know, of the library, you know, been removed. These displays have been undone. At the very least, they're not on display anymore, you know. And think about the gubernatorial election in Virginia. That was undone by angry parents. The angry parents who had enough of the school boards, and that was particularly school boards, who were completely indifferent to the needs of the parents, to, you know, to a girl being raped in the school bathroom by a boy in a dress, which of course the activists tell you will never happen. That's just, right. you're just fantasizing that such a thing could happen. And then the school board trying to cover it up and so on. The angry parents changed the course of that election. And so I think I think that we should take heart by that. I think we right. need to be encouraged by that.
Right. Let's talk about this upcoming summit you have. I believe it's the 5th annual summit.
That's right.
And first of all, just give us an overview of what it is, where it is, all the details.
Right. So it's a summit for survivors of the sexual revolution is what we call it. This is what we call our conference, our annual conference. To indicate what it's about, you know, that we're focused on these type of issues that you and I have been discussing here. And it will be June 24th and 25th of 2022, Friday and Saturday. And it will be in Lake Charles, Louisiana, which is where I live. The world headquarters of the Ruth Institute is in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And that may sound like it's out of the way, and it's sort of out of the way. But if you live on Highway 10, which is the southernmost interstate, it's between Houston and New Orleans. Okay, so you drive right past Lake Charles if you're driving down Highway 10. But anyway, it will be, like I said, the 24th and 25th of June. And we're still selling tickets to it, and we will close it down Monday morning. We have to give the headcount, final headcount to the caterer. So if you go on, if you watch this 2 weeks from now, you won't be able to join us in person, but there will still be virtual passes. So you can buy virtual access to it. You can watch the summit in real time from, you know, Ketchikan, Alaska, or wherever you happen to be. You can still participate. You can participate in real time. You can ask questions. You can be involved. And also, after the summit, you have immediate access to the raw video of the summit, because that material is not going to be released to the general public until much later, because it takes a long time to process video and all of that kind of thing. But you'll have access to it. Everybody who participates, whether virtually or in person, will have access to those videos really, really right away.
Now, of course, I'm sure anybody would benefit from this, but who particularly are the type of people you think would most benefit from attending this summit?
I would say our target market are the people who are already involved in some form of pro-life, pro-family ministry and who want to be more effective at it. Okay. And there are a lot of effective ministries out there. But what we do that I think is unique is we help people see how all the pieces fit together. And we help you see that what you're doing has effects over here and over there. And indeed, a lot of the people already know that. You know, your people who work in pregnancy care centers, for instance, they know perfectly well that they're engaged in hand-to-hand combat in the sexual revolution for each and every soul who walks through their door, you know. So to be better equipped to have a broader picture of what that is and what's driving it, and, you know, what are the incentives and what are the thought processes and stuff like that. You know, if you're all day at your pregnancy care center, you can't be thinking about transgenderism and informing yourself about that, you know? So if you come and hear our experts, you'll get a picture of what that is. So I don't, anyone who sits around and complains all day, don't show up. I don't have time for you. But if you, I mean, really, you think you have time to sit around and complain? Well, anyway, if you're already involved in something, we can help you be more effective. I feel quite certain about that.
That's great. And you have a great lineup of speakers, but I admit I have to call out one. My friend Paul Darrow is going to be speaking at that. And
he's a pal of yours, is he?
Yes. I met him when I was working down in Florida. We had him come down and speak, and just a wonderful, wonderful guy. If people who have ever seen the documentary Desire of the Everlasting Hills, Paul is one of the three people who are featured. These are people who lived a very promiscuous gay lifestyle, homosexual lifestyle. But then they were called out of it by the grace of God. Yes. And just the testimony, I just think his testimony and all their testimony, I mean, all the people on that movie, but plus and just in general, working through courage and things like that, is just so powerful, because what it really does show, Paul doesn't do this this isn't his intention, I don't think, but he reveals the lies of the homosexual movement better than anybody I know, because he just talks about his lifestyle and how it was so glamorous on the outside, yet it obviously was completely empty and destructive and awful. And I think that's the key, because when you watch the sitcoms on television, whatever, they always have a gay character whose life is just perfect and happy and everything. And there's nothing, and they're always the good guys, and they have a boyfriend, the guy has a boy, whatever, and everything's great. But then the reality.
That's right.
The reality of what really is. And I think that is, and I know when I first like worked with Courage years ago, but then talking to Paul and stuff, that really just changed my entire mentality. And here's how I think it changed. It was, I think we have a tendency, we conservatives, we have a tendency to look at, for example, homosexual activists as an enemy, as somebody to defeat. And I get that. And I'm not saying that isn't true on some level.
Right.
Yet the truth is, it's more like, a rescue mission than it is a battle, because we're trying to save them really from the destruction that they've wrought upon themselves. You know, and usually in so many cases, it's because of abuse in their background, or things have been done to them.
Yeah.
And so it's just, I mean, that's just one speaker at your summit that I know will hit the ball out of the ballpark. And I'm sure the other ones are great, but he alone, I think, is worth going to the summit, in my opinion.
Well, you know what? You should get a virtual pass and tune into the thing, you know, and then you'll have plenty of, you can write columns for months.
Yeah,
right. But with the people that we have, but what you just described, Eric, is what we refer to as the witnesses. Okay. So a Ruth Institute summit is a combination of witnesses, people who have been through the mill one way or the other and are willing to talk about it and willing to tell what it was really like. And we have others who talk about the LGBT subculture, you know, but we also in years past, we've had children of divorce and abandoned spouses, you know, because their witness stories have a lot in common, you know, one of which is that they're socially invisible. You never see heartbroken children of divorce on a sitcom, on a TV sitcom, just like you never see, you know, a gay man with, you know, who is incontinent. Right. Or who is unhappy. You know, you never see any of that. So the witnesses, that's a very important component of our whole structure. Then we also always have experts, what we would call subject matter experts. So, you know, so we'll have Dr. Quentin Van Meter, you know, talking about the medical costs of the sexual revolution, which certainly includes homosexuality, but a whole lot of other things, too. We'll have Father Paul Sullins, who is our senior research associate, who has written about numerous topics regarding the sexual revolution. But what he'll be talking about at the summit is, first of all, the changes possible. He'll be analyzing some of the studies on sexual orientation change efforts. And, you know, people don't actually commit suicide after going to a therapist, you know, for example. But also he's doing a whole talk on counting the casualties of the sexual revolution, just summarizing all that. So we have the experts, you know, that's another, the witnesses and the experts. And then we always have activists. We've always got people who are doing stuff. And, you know, because I want to inspire people to do things, you know. And so this year we give awards. And this year we're giving awards to Kristen Hawkins. Mm-hmm. We're giving her Pro-Life Leadership Award. She's the president of Students for Life of America. And then we're also giving awards for activists. The activists of the year are two women who founded a group called Advocates Protecting Children, which is a group that deals with the trans issue. And these are two moms who are on fire about this issue. And so if you come and you're there in person, you will feel the energy, you know, in the room by these people who are just on fire for what they're doing.
And I think it's great, by the way, that you guys are down in Louisiana and not in a place like Los Angeles or whatever, because I think that's how you build the communities, is, you know, places like that where it's the insanity hopefully is not quite as insane as right. It might be right. In a New York City or something like that. So I think it's great you're down there. So
well,
how
I
do
appreciate, people? I appreciate you saying that, because we left, my husband and I moved out of San Diego in 2015 because right. We just couldn't take it anymore.
Right.
You know, we left a place that has the best weather in the world,
right.
And went to move in a swamp. Okay.
Right.
But we love it here.
And I think a lot of families are doing things like that. And I think that's what has to be done, because you got to focus on that community is like building up your local community is so important. And so,
yes.
Yeah. So I think that's great.
And also it's a kind of, I felt, you know, that's how my husband and I, as a couple, would think of it. But as far as the Ruth Institute was concerned, I viewed it as a strategic retreat, because you can get more done in an environment where people support you. You know, I mean, in San Diego, I was afraid to have a sign on the door. I didn't want to announce where I worked, you know, where I lived. But here, I'm a respected member of the Chamber of Commerce here. Right. We had a ribbon cutting, and the mayor sent a representative to my ribbon cutting.
I mean, right there, that's a perfect, that encapsulates exactly why you would do something like that.
Right.
I mean, it's exactly. Perfect. How do people register for the summit?
RuthInstitute.org, baby. RuthInstitute.org. You go over there and it'll be very obvious. Summit. picture of Kristen Hawkins, and you go and you find the register page and all the different options are there. The virtual pass is at the very bottom. There's a little explanation of it. If you see this in time and are so inclined, of course, we'd love for you to come for the whole thing. It's a full 2 days. If you do the whole Premium Summit experience, Eric, it's a full 2 days. It's all day Friday, then the awards dinner Friday night, and then a full day of summiting and lecturing and things like that on Saturday. So that's the basic setup.
That's great. That's great. Okay. And I'll make sure I put a link in the show notes so people can easily get to it. So
that would be great. We would really appreciate that. We would love to see crisis viewers, crisis readers down in Louisiana for our,
yes, for our, that would be great. Yeah, definitely. Sounds like a great time and very educational too. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you being on the program and I wish you great success with the summit, but then continue doing what you've been doing for a very long time now.
Well, thanks very much, Eric. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show with you.
Great. Okay. Until next time, everybody, God love you.